From the Sky News Centre at 5, anti-terror police are looking for a suspect behind London's fourth attack this summer. A device exploded on a busy tube train at Parsons Green Station in Fulham during this morning's rush hour. Emma Stevie was caught up in the rush to get out.
The little boy that smashed his face into the steps. There was a lady underneath me that was shouting, "I'm pregnant, I'm pregnant."
22 people have been treated in hospital, but none of the injuries is thought to be serious. Witnesses saw ambulances taking victims away as they were brought out of the station.
I just saw crazy commotion, loads of ambulances, police cars, fire engines.
There were a few people wheeled out on stretchers with really bad burns and cling film wrapped around their legs and some on their face.
A 50-metre cordon's in place around the underground station. Pupils were led out by teachers this afternoon as schools nearby were evacuated. One was placed on lockdown for several hours with armed officers outside. The Prime Minister has chaired a meeting of the government's Cobra Emergency Committee, but says there'll be no change to the terror threat level, which is currently at severe. And she praised emergency services for their efforts.
The police and security services are obviously doing all the work to discover the full circumstances of this cowardly attack and to identify those responsible.
She was also asked about a tweet by Donald Trump this morning, which suggested Scotland Yard knew who was responsible. The Prime Minister says it's not helpful to speculate. Let's get some other news quickly now. And police say they're increasingly concerned about missing former footballer Clark Carlisle. His wife claims he was last seen in Manchester City Centre this morning at around 6 a.m. A 20-year NASA mission's come to an end with the craft burning up in Saturn's atmosphere. The Cassini probe was transmitting data right up to the moment it was deliberately crashed into the planet because its fuel was running out. And in sport, Essex have won cricket's county championship. It's the first time they've done that since 1992. That's the latest. I'm Simon English.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Labour MP for Bristol South, Karen Smith. After the 6 o'clock news, a firebomb on a London tube this morning, but how many Syrian and Yemenis has our taxpayers' money killed this week? We look at a little bit of the news agenda and why some lives seem to be worth more than others around the world. We also follow up on last week's 9/11 special by looking at some further aspects of the mother of all attacks and also the Israeli Armed Forces, a programme called the Talpiot programme for getting their soldiers and spies into key positions as chief executive in high-tech corporations. The programme's been going since the 1980s. Even our military have to trust and rely on some of them right across the West. And we take a look at transhumanism's links to fascism with author of Transhumanism, A Dangerous Idea, David Livingston. He started by deconstructing myths about Western civilization and has identified high-tech companies such as Google as representing a shop window for these ideas where a privileged elite can be above the war and someday hope to become gods. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, it's lows of 10 Celsius and some light rain this weekend. Highs of 16, mainly cloudy, with some sunny spells and showers tomorrow. Next week, highs of 18 Celsius, sunny spells and showers at times during the week. And next weekend, that's the 23rd and 24th of September, highs, well, it's not very high, is it really? 18, actually not too bad, I suppose, for the time of year. Sunshine and heavy showers next weekend, so maybe we'll have the weather a little bit better this weekend, but not a lot. Yes, we're getting into autumn, aren't we? That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Labour MP for Bristol South, Karen Smith. Hi, Karen. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Thank you.
Maybe you could just start by telling us about the whole sort of parliamentary thing. You're back in Westminster now, I imagine, after a month's break, a bit like the school kids, really.
We've been back for 2 weeks. Listeners may remember a few years ago, David Cameron brought Parliament back for 2 weeks and then breaks for another 3 weeks for the conference season, which is causing some consternation with our SNP colleagues because they have their conference over a weekend and they're complaining because there's more of them than there are Liberal Democrats and they get a whole week for their conference. I do think there should be better arrangements for sorting out conference season, but we have been back for 2 weeks, mainly about the European Withdrawal Bill, obviously the greatest piece of legislation to come before Parliament for a very long time, with huge ramifications on the future of our country and our economy. And that's what's mainly been preoccupying us.
Well, I know, yes. I mean, was it really any point in trying to oppose it with the Conservatives and the DUP having a majority?
Well, then you're sounding a bit like Theresa May, if I may say so, and there's no point in turning up. That is not the job, I'm afraid, of an opposition. It is our job to
oppose everything?
Not oppose anything, constructively work with people to get the best deal for the people we all want to represent. But I think what we've seen this week is something really quite concerning in the approach of the Tories to any sort of opposition. You may have heard that even on our opposition day they refused to vote because they knew they were going to lose the vote.
But if it's a withdrawal bill, surely, I mean, if you're going to oppose it, that implies that you don't want to withdraw from the EU.
No, it implies, as we've clearly said, that it is such a fundamentally flawed piece of legislation that we had to oppose it.
So what's the main problem with it?
The main problem is there are a few clauses in it that particularly hand so much power to ministers without any kind of detail on how that might work beyond whatever we call exit day. Now, there are a lot of amendments down. It is a really complex piece of legislation. The lawyers amongst parliamentarians and outside are obviously experts at following this through. There are things in the European law that have underpinned our laws now for 40 years. We want to make sure that individuals have rights to pursue those rights. But at the end of the day, it is these powers that are focused so much on individual ministers that won't bear any kind of scrutiny.
But the Tories will say, you know, we've just got to simply get on with this.
They are trying to sell it as a very simple concept, isn't it? That you just transfer, it's just a transfer, it's just a nice little paper exercise. But because of the way the negotiations on the deal goes and the timing, and it's all hangs around the exit day of March 2019.
But the problem is with the laws, isn't it? Current laws that have been brought in through the European Union, there's a lack of clarity as to what will happen to those after we leave. Will they still be part of British law or not?
Well, the problem is some of the timing, and the problem is exactly the sort of what they're calling tidying up, which we would be very concerned about. Who does that so-called tidying up, and the amount of power in individual ministers?
Well, that tidying up is quite important, though, when it comes to the law. If we leave the EU
absolutely.
And we don't know what our laws are anymore, that would be a bit of a mess.
Which is one of the reasons we felt that we had to oppose it. We asked questions about... We asked them to compromise on it when the white paper came out and pointed out some of these problems. They've had months to try and to do that and trying to make it work better, and they haven't.
Well, I noticed also this week that the President of the European Commission, who's sometimes called the President of Europe, not that often, but he's kind of characterised himself as that, Jean-Claude Juncker, gave his speech entitled the State of the European Union Address. Now, this is all starting to sound a little bit like the US, isn't it, Karen? And I wonder, in fact, the headline of the Telegraph yesterday was United States of Europe. Although he didn't use those words in his speech, a lot of people are saying, well, that's exactly what he wants. He doesn't want any countries now to be half in and half out of the European Union. He doesn't want any to be able to choose over their currencies, and of course that would affect Britain massively. Britain has decided, for whatever reason, it doesn't want to join the euro, and he's saying that the other countries which are out of the euro, they're going to have to join now. No choice.
So what's the question in that?
Well, the question is, do you think is it a United States of Europe?
Is he right in what he's doing? These are not new arguments, are they? The original vision for Europe was predicated on what exactly this sort of form takes. Is the United States, how do you maintain sort of national sovereignty within that? So these aren't new arguments. And I think... I think what's really happening, and what we all need to recognise here in the UK... is that Europe is not static. When we talk about what the future might look like, everything is changing in Europe as well as changing here.
But so can countries sovereign within the EU? I mean, I think that's a crucial question, isn't it? Can they? They can. But the thing is that the EU is making laws for them. So, you know, how the two don't seem to sort of fit together.
The EU does not exist beyond us. We have been part of that law-making process.
And when David Cameron said we want to have more powers, he was told, really, just to go away with his tail between his legs, wasn't he, back beginning of last year?
He did come back with more powers. And actually, what David Cameron did so badly wrong was take himself out of the moderate conservative group and therefore give up any kind of influence. I mean, I was in favour of the EU. I think it's the wrong decision to leave, but the decision has been made. And what Cameron started, but, you know, was to withdraw his influence and therefore be outside the tent. And my view is always you've got to be inside and using your power and influence to make things better, not taking your ball away. But, you know, that's a decision he made 10 years ago.
Anyway, Jean-Claude Juncker, let's have a little listen to a little excerpt from his speech translated here into English.
March 29th, 2019, that was the date where the United Kingdom will leave the European Union. This will be a very sad and tragic moment in our history. We will always regret this, and I think that you will regret it as well soon, if I might say. Nonetheless, we have to respect the will of the British people. But we are going to make progress. We will keep moving. We will move on because Brexit isn't everything. It's not the future of Europe. It's not the be-all and end-all.
Karen, do you agree with Juncker there? Will we regret it?
We don't know, do we? I mean, I think anybody realistically now who's saying they know how this is going to work is, you know, they don't. They don't know. We don't know. It's incumbent on all of us, though, to make sure, as we would like the tone and approach to be very different, to recognise that our history, our country is intertwined, is part of Europe, and we will all coexist together, and prosperity should be shared, etc. You know, Juncker has got his task to do to make sure the rest of it stays together and is strong. It's a negotiating position, aren't we? We're all in a bit in this sort of funny phase at the moment.
They're not closing the Channel Tunnel, though, are they? That's going to carry on.
No,
people, trade is going to carry on in some form,
yes.
and people will still be visiting us, and we'll be visiting them.
We hope
them.
So, absolutely.
Martin, do you think Juncker's right? We'll regret it?
I think it's possible. The real danger is if it turns into a train wreck for whatever reason, because of the, you know, people can't agree, then a speculator like Soros will take a short position on the pound. The pound has already lost 20% of its value as a result of the Brexit vote, which is feeding now into the main economy. If there's another attack on the pound, they may have to raise interest rates to protect the currency. Hammond will have to do that. And at that point, the property market in Britain collapses and we fall into recession. And that's the danger if we get it wrong.
Well, another person who had something to say about Juncker's State of the European Union speech was, bless him, Nigel Farage.
Mr. Juncker, that was the most open, honest and truly worrying speech I've heard in my long years. In this place, the message is very clear. Brexit has happened, full steam ahead. So new plans. There's to be one powerful president for the whole of the European Union. A finance minister with fresh powers to, as you say yourself, intervene as and when he sees necessary. A stronger European army in a militarised European Union with a stronger and perhaps more aggressive foreign policy too. And more Europe in every single direction, and all of it to be done without the consent of the people. Your plan to fight the next European elections with cross-European, pan-European lists funded by the European Union, but not, as you said, to fund extremists, means what we will find is genuine democratic parties of opposition will not be able to compete in elections on the same playing field. It is reminiscent of regimes of old. Indeed, the way you're treating Hungary and Poland already must remind them of living under the Soviet communists when you attempt to tell them how they should run their own countries. All I can say is thank God we're leaving. but you've learnt nothing from Brexit. If you'd given Cameron concessions, particularly on immigration, the Brexit vote, I have to admit, would never, ever have happened.
That's Nigel Farage there, former UKIP leader. I think if the clapometer is anything to go by, Juncker actually won, Martin, there.
Well, it's not surprising because of the audience, let's face it. It's a European audience.
Well, it's an enormous audience in the European Parliament to Farage as well.
Well, indeed. But, I mean, Farage is grandstanding there, as he normally does. I was reading a quote from Farage earlier today where he was saying, well, we could have a Norway option if we vote for leave the European Union. And Aaron Banks also said the same thing. Well, we're probably going to stay in the single market. So less than a year ago, these people were suggesting that we could leave the European Union and stay in the single market, and therefore it would be safe to vote to leave the EU. They've changed their tune, haven't they?
Well, I mean, Juncker was saying that there may be no Norway option, that it's going to be everyone's going to have to join the euro, and there may be no kind of flim-flamming and parting.
Well, Norway won't have to join the euro because Norway's not in the European Union, but it's still in the single market. And that was an option that was discussed in a quite lazy fashion in the run-up to the referendum. And there was certainly no majority for leaving the single market. In fact, many people campaigned for leave, said we can leave, but we can remain in the single market. That's all gone down the drain, hasn't it?
And I think when we get beyond all the chest beating, which is what with the process we're in, particularly before the German elections, the Europeans want us in, and they want our economy, they want our skills, they want to work with us, and we want to work with them. So that's the position we need to get to, where it is in our mutual interest to work together. And I agree with Martin, that there's a lot of grandstanding going on there, because there is a democratic link into Europe. We have voted for MEPs. I think my own view is that we should have been quicker earlier about making that democratic link more obvious and making more relevant the role the European Union does play in our lives and how it works. And we've allowed this narrative to develop, propagated by people like Nigel Farage, that there's no democracy and there's this thing that does everything to us.
No, I think
and it's just not true.
But the thing is that the Parliament has got far, far less powers than our Parliament, and the Commission has a lot more powers than our government in Europe. So, you know, you've got and they're unelected. And I think the main problem for me anyway with Europe is that you've got people at the Commission who are failed politicians. I mean, they've stood for election like you've done, Karen, and they've been kicked out one way or another, and then they find themselves in the European Commission running the show.
Well, I mean, this is why I do think that the relationship between the Council, the Commission and Parliament is something, and it has been the subject of discussions and was evolving to something else, and I think it will evolve further. So Juncker's model of this week may not be what we end up with. I think other countries will have something to say about that, and I think people will learn the lessons of Brexit in terms of what it means for their own populations and giving people control, because my own view is that the slogan "Take Back Control" was the very, very powerful one.
Well, let's come back down to earth with the bump. We're not now trying to do crystal ball gazing over Brexit and looking at what's going to happen on the 29th of March 2019. This is last Saturday here in Bristol on College Green, and the journalist Owen Jones giving a speech at the anti-austerity rally.
They thought they'd get away with it, that wealth and power would be concentrated in the hands of this tiny elite, that the banks would carry on paying record bonuses, that the tax dodgers would keep dodging those taxes, that the poverty-paying bosses would keep paying those poverty wages. What were they thinking? Did they really think the people of this country, with its proud history of struggle, of those who fought for the rights of women to vote, who fought for the rights of workers, who fought for the welfare state, for the NHS, who fought racism and homophobia and transphobia, who fought the poll tax and brought Margaret Thatcher down, did they think we were going to stand and take it? Well, they've got a rude awakening now, haven't they? A very rude awakening.
Well, that's stirring words there from Owen Jones on College Green last Saturday.
So were you there?
I was on the march, but I didn't go to the actual speeches.
Okay.
So I'm glad to have heard that.
But anyway, what he's saying effectively there is, how dare they? But the thing is, they do dare, and there's not a lot we can do unless somebody who's in elected power does it.
Well, what that implies is we've got to get this government out. And it's quite possible. You saw what happened this week. The DUP voted with Labour against the cap on the public sector pay. and the government had to abstain because otherwise they would have lost. In other words, the DUP are not in fact reliable allies of the government on the austerity agenda, as they never were going to be. And it's quite possible that the government will fall. So, and if it falls, we'll have an election, and then we'll have a different government, and we'll have a different thing to talk about.
This is starting to get interesting, Karen, isn't it? You know, if the only thing that the government's got a majority on now is the Brexit with the DUP alliance, then it looks like they may not actually be able to do anything else.
There's a lot of things in there. I think there is more than just Brexit or the sort of the welfare and benefits issues. But no, it is. I will say to people, as a long student of politics, it's very interesting reading about it. It's not been so easy sometimes being in the middle of it. And it's certainly a very unpredictable and interesting time. But it's also very worrying for lots of people because people don't like uncertainty. In some of politics, Brexit brings a lot of uncertainty to the situation.
But I mean, surely the main uncertainty is when you've got a minority government. I mean, yes. That just makes things very,
it
very
does.
Iffy.
It does. And it's totally totally unpredictable. So you can't even what the votes are on or what comes before, because no government can predict what is going to come before it.
So what's your take on why Theresa May threw it all away? I mean, she had it, everything she wanted.
Arrogance. Yeah. Pure arrogance. I said it at the time when you could tell very quickly that people at that point were thinking, you know, we've had an election, we've had our referendum, go away and get on with it. That is the most common thing that I get to me. You know, people say lots of things about MPs, but many of them come to me and say, well, that's what we send you off to do. And why has she come back to ask for more votes? It was shocking. And they didn't want to talk about particularly social care. I do think that's one of the biggest things in society, and we don't talk about it enough and don't sort it. And people took the opportunity to talk about the things that really mattered to them.
Anyway, we all know that things aren't working very well with the economy. We're going to hear some more from Prime Minister's questions about that later on. But now let's have a listen to the Labour Mayor Marvin Rees's speech. And I thought we'd just listen to his solutions, because I think we spent quite a long time talking about how things aren't working in various ways to do with education, health, etc. So I was much more interested to hear what Marvin's got in the way of a vision and a solution.
Let me just say, this is not the end. This is a first step. The core cities have come together to produce a paper that we are taking to government next Tuesday. That's the first step. We've got a room, we'll have the cabinet, we'll have shadow cabinet, we'll have MPs and third parties. We will be saying to government, we need a new deal. We need a new kind of relationship in which you invest in cities that keep this country moving. We will go from there into party conference season. We'll ask this team to be taken into conference, and we go into budget. But let me ask you to do a few things before you leave today. One is, can I ask you before the day is out to take your phone and commit to texting 20 people and tell them they need to write to their MP, they need to make it clear to government that the cities need a new deal. We cannot go on as we are going. Austerity is a choice, and austerity is costing life and costing hope. It's breeding hopelessness into our city. But there are things we can do right now in Bristol also. And there are volunteers around today who are asking people to come forward. One is, what I need from people in Bristol while we take on government and while we stand up, these are some practical things. Would you volunteer to become a support reader in schools? We need 300 people to start reading with our school kids to improve literacy and improve life chances. If you would, go to the Labour stand, volunteer. Would you help us make sure that every young person in Bristol gets access to work experience? At the moment, half of young people do not get access to good quality work experience. That impacts on their whole career trajectory and impacts on social mobility. Would you join us in volunteering to go out and help people register to vote so that people's voice is genuinely heard at the next general election? Would you put your name forward to be part of a general bank of volunteers that we can call on when the next calls, whether we're running a hunger programme or a homelessness programme? we would welcome you considering all those things. And would you consider becoming a foster family or coming forward to adopt? We have 700 children in Bristol in the care system. You can make an intervention that changes someone's whole life chances. So we're going to do the big things about taking on government. We're going to do the big things about taking on power. But we also got to say is, what can we do right here, right now with what we've got? And we're putting those things forward. And maybe make one last little request. I would love us to leave this grass cleaner than when we found it. Please just make sure there's no litter when we leave. Thank you, and thank you for loving Bristol. You make me proud. Thank you.
Well, that's Bristol's Mayor Marvin Rees there speaking last Saturday at an austerity rally. The Bristol Post reporting something like 8,000 people there. Other reports, other people I've spoken to, photographers and stuff who were there, saying around about 3,000. But Karen, I mean, this is great ideals here. He's going to see government next Tuesday, but effectively the government didn't want to see him, did they? I mean, he ended up actually only talking to other core city mayors and other delegations from other core cities. So it's been effectively, what they're saying is, we've got a vision for these mostly Labour controlled core cities around the country. The government is not interested.
I think it was. I mean, I was there in London on Tuesday, and I think it's really quite shocking that nobody from the government side was came to meet the leaders of our core cities, which are generating the greatest wealth and which most people do live in. But they chose not to do that. I think what was interesting about Tuesday was that Judith Bake, who leads that from Leeds, announced that Michel Barnier wants to meet with the leaders of our core cities to talk to them about Brexit and implications and how they're working, which is another layer in the tail, if you like, about how important our economy and our people and our skills are to the Europeans and we are to them. So, again, it's another a piece of the jigsaw, if you like, of how complicated and complex all of this is now.
A lot of people saying, though, that Marvin should be using some of our reserves to keep things like libraries open. I mean, we're hearing now that we're going to have the biggest library closure programme in the country in Bristol.
Well, things like reserves are, and I'm not a local government expert, but things like reserves are, there's a technical term for what they are counted against. They're like an insurance policy against a risk register for particular things, and they are one-off expenditure, so they are not a long-term solution. The local government has been hit by these massive reductions since 2010. Also affects Tory councils. But I think what, you know, I'd say to any Tory MPs listening in this evening to us in our local area is that Bristol may have a Labour mayor and Labour MPs, but we are the growth generator for the wider region. We have a Tory metro mayor. We're critically important to Gloucestershire and North Somerset and so on. And it is incumbent on them to also go back to their own government to say, We need Bristol to make sure it has the deal that we can support the wider economy. I think it's very short-sighted of the government. But we will keep pressing them. We'll have to.
Martin, there's a whole range of things that Marvin's saying we can do. One is texting MPs. Another is going to help in schools. Another one is helping people with work experience. Another one is helping them register to vote. Presumably, he wants them to be voting Labour. But, I mean, is there really nothing else that we can do as a city? Whatever, it's 350,000 people.
Well, it's very tricky, isn't it? I think it's quite right to say that you can't just dip into the reserves. And I know some of the Greens and others have been suggesting that we could do that. If there was going to be a quick change at the centre, that might be worth the risk. But we're not sure that there is going to be a quick change at the centre. So you've got to keep your reserves for, because you may need them for something coming up. I think the best we can hope for is that this shambolic government collapses quite quickly. And that's what I am hoping for. Because in actual fact, they're finding it very difficult.
I'll reiterate again
that the DUP voted with Labour this week against the government.
But, I mean, don't hold your breath, is what I'll say, because they're going to stick with it, aren't they, if they possibly can. Anyway, looking at some of the figures this week, and they will say, of course, we're doing really well. 4.3% UK unemployment falls to a 42-year low. This is Business Insider. UK unemployment has fallen to its lowest level since 1975, according to data from the Office of National Statistics. Now, this is showing that all they need to do is keep on track and everybody will have a job.
Well, that's not true. Don't forget that in 1975 unemployment was over a million, and I'm old enough to remember when unemployment went over a million in 1973, and it was regarded as an absolutely shocking state of affairs, and people thought that the sky was going to fall on our heads. We've got used to this now as if it's normal. It's not normal, but we've got used to it. So the fact that we've got now on paper down to 4.3% unemployment, as you well know, unemployment and inflation are constantly being manipulated as statistics. Governments constantly try to massage them. And don't forget, if we're underestimating inflation, we're overestimating GDP growth. You know, that all of these things come in. I think people can sense what's happening. We're not firing on all cylinders. We've got a low-wage, low-productivity economy where people are doing lots and lots of crummy jobs, and we've got zero interest rates for nearly 10 years. Any raise in interest rates, for example, from a run on the pound, as I suggested earlier, and all this house of cards will collapse.
Now, you sent me an interesting article also from Business Insider, Martin, a couple of weeks ago on the 30th of August. Jim Edwards wrote this. He says there's more evidence that the true rate of unemployment in the UK is three times greater than the government's statistics suggest. 14.5% of UK households are workless, according to the Office of National Statistics. That's three times as high as the headline unemployment rate, which is supposed to be 4.5%. So it does seem, Karen, there's a bit of figure fixing going on here, and the real unemployment rate could be more like 13, 14, even 15%.
I mean, the problem that we've got, and certainly we have, that I see regularly, is people are in work. They're doing several jobs, many of them low paid. We have a productivity problem, but we do also have a lot of people on disability who aren't able to work for one reason or another, and that's another aspect of what we see in the figures. But you know, Martin's right in the sense of people's purchasing power, their ability to go out to work and to be able to afford to live. The very basic requirements that people want is to put a roof over their head and feed their families and perhaps go on holiday once a year. That's not been able to be achieved with the low wages and insecurity of work that we've got. And to echo back to the previous point we were making about opportunities for young people to have work experience. That's something I did last year, actually, is ask people in South Bristol if you can go into schools and help people work experience to get them into the good jobs that actually there are available in Bristol. What I see in South Bristol is that there are jobs in Bristol that are well paid and require good skills, and they are not being filled by people from South Bristol who are not having the skills able to get into those jobs, which is why I focus on apprenticeships and so on. So there's a lot going on in that sub-economy that is being missed and you know, not helping the people that we really need to help.
And for the self-employed as well, average wages, this is Ben Chu writing in The Independent last year, average wages for self-employed are still lower than two decades ago. The Resolution Foundation estimated that the average earnings for people in the self-employed group are only around £240 a week. Now, this has plummeted, Martin, since 2010, the actual average earnings of the self-employed.
Well, in other words, there's two sorts of self-employment, isn't there? There's self-employment where you're actually, you know, getting a step up on the ladder, you're earning more, you're becoming your own boss, and there's self-employment where you've been made redundant and you're just scrabbling around to try and find any kind of work you can get.
Oh, I mean, selling stuff you find in the street on eBay or something, yeah. You know. Actually, now, you know, you can be doing that, getting a tiny income every week and be claiming tax credits.
Yeah, or universal credit. And the other thing that's come out this week is the National Audit Office did a study on homelessness, and there's been a massive increase in homelessness since the Tories came to power in 2010.
I think that's true, and
that's because people got no money.
But I think, to pick up Tony's point about that type of work and the support from tax credits, I mean, some of that is very, very helpful for people to get them back into work. They may be undertaking caring responsibilities and or other sorts of things happening in their lives that level of getting back into work and the dignity that comes from work is a good thing, and the system should support that.
Look, there's one thing at the back of all of this, and that is this whole thing of there's just not enough money. Well, hang on a minute, because we're the fifth or sixth richest country in the world. There's plenty of money out there sloshing around. Most of it has been invested, and it's giving a return on shares. It's also being invested in things like property, buy-to-let property, that sort of thing. So there's plenty of money out there. Is the government actually ever going to get, and maybe would Labour ever get to the stage where they start thinking, well, we should actually start using quantitative easing money, and rather than use it to prop up the stock market and prop up property prices, to actually start spending it on the people that actually need it, because they, we know, will spend that money and actually kick off the wider economy. They're likely to spend that money, which will be to the benefit of everybody, rather than the QE money, which is hardly going anywhere. Maybe Martin.
Well, I think that's right. I think the technical term for this is helicopter money, and Simon Wren-Lewis talks about this on his blog, mainly macro. He's a university professor, Oxford University professor of economics. But the point about that is that that's for an emergency. If there's another crash associated with Brexit or a collapse in the US or whatever, you might then want to consider helicopter money, giving people money directly. And of course, in Japan, they have done this. 20 years ago, they did it.
But there is another version feasible. That people like Richard Murphy have talked about, which is people's QE, which is the government simply saying, rather than giving that printed money to prop up bonds and shares and property, we need to just be spending it. And with the QE question in the back of my mind, I thought this was actually a really good question, and I'm not actually even sure what party this chap's from, at Prime Minister's question this week.
Mr. Speaker, the UK's record in earnings has been significantly worse than almost every other developed country. In fact, real wages in the UK have fallen by 2.6% since 2007. Wages aren't growing. The cost of living is rising. Household budgets are stretched. Mr. Speaker, the government can find the money for quantitative easing, £435 billion since 2009, but can't find the money for fiscal measures to grow the economy. This is a government that does not understand how to use economic levers, and it's our people that are paying the price. Will the Prime Minister take responsibility for the government's gross mismanagement of the UK economy?
And I notice, I think that in all of that rather lengthy question that the Honourable Gentleman asked, never once did he record the increase in employment that has taken place across the United Kingdom and what the figures show today. But he started off by standing up and complaining that I'd referenced the acts of the Scottish Government. He believes in independence. He believes that Scotland should only be run by the Scottish Government. So I think the Scottish people deserve to look, and in this House we deserve to talk about what the Scottish Government is or is not doing for the people of Scotland. The one thing I can tell him and others is that the Scottish economy and the livelihoods of the people of Scotland are better off in the United Kingdom.
Well, I always like an MP if they can actually quote some figures, and that's a fascinating figure. Since 2009, Karen, the Bank of England has created out of thin air, almost like the Wizard of Oz, £435 billion, and very little of it seems to be coming to us, does it?
Yes, well, I think that those are figures that we've used previously and pretty certain in our manifesto. And I guess I'm an old-fashioned Keynesian, really. You know, the building, the infrastructure that we need to grow our economy, to support people into work with the skills they need, returning skills, you know, not that it all finishes when you're 18 if you haven't chosen the right skills, which is why I think our National Education Service that we talked about in our manifesto are all things that we should be thinking about our long-term productivity. And I would agree, I think the Tories are very short-sighted, short-term, and that is a fundamental problem in our economy from which people are suffering.
Martin, £435 billion. I mean, almost doesn't bear thinking about. It's a fantastic amount of money. I think even with the highest estimates of what HS2 is supposed to cost, that's about five HS2 projects. Why is this money going in that direction and not actually being spent by the government, you know, on infrastructure projects and also on just basically helping people maybe even start businesses, create jobs?
Well, it's basically ideological. I mean, in the past, what used to happen, and Tory governments would be the same as Labour governments, is that they would spend money and borrow to invest in infrastructure, as Karen suggested, the Keynesian era. And then, of course, what happened in 2008 is that there was some kind of ideological fixation that we couldn't do that, but we could bail out the existing financial institutions, which is exactly what we did. And of course, the danger with bailing anything out, as Milton Friedman pointed out years ago, is you don't just do it once. You bail out a failed industry like the financial services sector, they come back for more and more and more. Now, it can make sense to bail out a steel industry or a car industry while it retools itself, but bailing out a financial services industry is clearly a one-way street, and the right-wing economists who agree with this, all that happens then is you just give them a free lunch.
Martin,
and that's what they've had, a free lunch for 10 years.
Is it actually an industry? I mean,
isn't it really, is it? That's the problem. It's actually just an intermediation mechanism. It's supposed to be the oil in the engine, and it's supposed to be there to help the rest of the economy function.
In a way, it's more of a utility, isn't it, rather than actually an
industry. Well, once you've nationalised the banks, you could argue that it is a utility. But, of course, if you remember, thinking back to Gordon Brown, he was desperate not to nationalise Northern Rock, and even when he'd nationalised it, he didn't want to call it nationalisation. So they then set up a hands-off organisation to run it, and basically turn it back into a private bank. And of course that was a missed opportunity. If all over the world, including the United States of America, the government stepped in to bail out the financial sector, then at that point you've nationalised it. But of course we've given them the money, but we've not insisted on any kind of power
just
or control.
Just checking up, by the way, on Ian Blackford, who you heard there asking that question, I thought rather well, was he's a SNP MP for Ross, Skye and Lock Harbour. So in a way, I wonder if it's something to do with they have really good independent free press and a lot of free thinking people out in the Western Islands of Scotland, don't they?
Well, they just have a better education system as well.
Maybe they
do. I don't know what you're suggesting. What are you suggesting? he replaced Charlie Kennedy in the 2015. He's the new leader in the House of Commons. Because the last one lost.
Anyway, I just thought I was really rather impressed. Anyway, so as a result of all of this, Jeremy Corbyn and Theresa May, the leader of the opposition and the Prime Minister, had a bit of a tussle on the sort of results, I suppose, of what's going on with the economy.
Mr. Speaker, the Institute of Fiscal Studies reports that English graduates have the highest student debts anywhere in the world. Yeah. Poorest students now graduating with an average debt of £57,000. Who is responsible but her party and the Liberal Democrats of that situation? Mr. Speaker, we're in the middle of an economic slowdown. The OBR says there is a growing risk of recession under her watch. Growth is slowing, productivity worsening, wages falling, jobs becoming more insecure, personal debt increasing, saving levels falling, and homelessness rising all over the country. And it's forecast that by the end of this Parliament, 5 million children in this country, the fifth richest country in the world, will be living in poverty. Isn't it true that not only is our economy at breaking point, but for many people, it's already broken as they face up to the poverty imposed by this government?
Can I just say to the Right Honourable Gentleman, yet again, he has failed to mention on student fees. Who was it who introduced tuition fees? That introduced tuition fees. But let's look at what has happened. Let's look at what has happened in our economy. What do we see? Record levels of direct investment in the British economy. Firms investing in this country because they believe in the future of this country. What we also see from the employment figures today, more people in work than ever before. We see more women in work. We see more 16 to 24-year-olds in work or in full-time education than we've seen before. That's what you get with a strong economy. And what do we know and what do the people know? That the Labour Party, with its high debt, its high taxes, its fewer jobs, Labour Party would only destroy our economy as they did last time. We had to sort it out. The only people who pay the price for the Labour Party are ordinary working families.
I think from those sorts of exchanges, does anybody really learn anything? And it's like we're talking in two different languages, isn't it? Which, given that there's a lot of agreement on things like productivity and how important it is for the economy, as I think I said earlier, the need to look long-term, not have this short-termist fix, is really problematic.
Well, I mean, in another universe, you could imagine, with Brexit on the table and so on, they'd be trying to put together a kind of a grand coalition, sort of the sort that you have in Austria or Germany, where we've got agreement about certain things, and therefore we could then present a united front to the Europeans. But of course, it's not possible in Britain's adversarial system, where, you know, one side claims one lot of things, the other side claims another lot of things, and prime ministers' questions is a kind of
It does seem to be a bit of a firewall.
I'm not a great fan of prime ministers' questions, as you know.
There does seem to be a bit of a firewall around this government. We were hearing earlier as well about the core cities. They won't even talk to the core cities.
Well, not talking to them at all is very odd. I mean, that wouldn't happen in other European countries. They'd be expected to talk to them.
I mean,
but
I think
it does in this country.
They would say, it's not for me to talk for the Tory government, but I think they would say that they are talking. I think that sense of not coming to that room to talk to them on Tuesday was misjudged. But I would agree, Tony, I think there is a bit of a firewall developing. I think that's partly what the election was like. They didn't get the result. You know, Theresa May started off the Brexit thing saying no running commentary. I don't need to bring the deal in front of you. We have dragged them to the House of Commons to make statements, which means they're on record every single step of the way. And this week, I've been quite shocked, really, about their behaviour in terms of not responding to votes, in terms of sort of a bit of a cliche, but this power grab, really, now to say no opposition. We were accused this week of moaning or being hot air. I mean, lots of listeners may think, well, all politicians are full of hot air. And essentially saying, we want no opposition. And in a democracy, I think that's really, really, really concerning.
Well, we're doing a bit of opposition, I suppose, today, aren't we, in really trying to call some of these people to account. And our next item is about a particular place where it doesn't seem as if they've been called to account at all, which is the Grenfell Tower fire. It was Will Self, I think, on Prime Minister's, not in Prime Minister's Questions, on BBC Question Time last night, that pointed out that the police really should have been round and feeling some collars over this, but there still haven't been any arrests, even though there is a pretty good idea of what happened. There's also looking online at the Justice for Grenfell's website, saying, well, we pretty much know what happened. And so spending months and months, if not a year, looking into what happened seems almost pointless. The main thing is, how can we get changes made that mean that this can't happen again? But anyway, let's have a listen now to a little clip from an Al Jazeera report from yesterday's announcement, 3 months after the Grenfell Tower fire, that the public inquiry is starting.
We want to know the truth.
They argue it's a cover-up before it's even begun. But Sir Martin Morbick says he is determined to find out the truth. His inquiry began with a minute's silence, an acknowledgement of how much suffering the Grenfell Tower fire has caused.
The inquiry cannot undo any of that, but it can and will provide answers to the pressing questions of how a disaster of this kind could occur in 21st century London, and thereby, I hope, provide a small measure of solace.
Sir Martin Morbick has disappointed residents by not including advisers who represent the local community. He says he has to be impartial, but he offered words of reassurance.
We share a common goal. We are all searching after the truth about the cause of the fire and the massive loss of life that it caused. And we owe it to those who died and to those whose homes have been destroyed to work together to achieve that goal.
Now, Karen Smith, Labour MP for Bristol South, do you think this is going to make much of a difference, this inquiry? Is it going to get to the truth?
Yes, I mean, having an inquiry is the right thing. We have to trust in that process of that inquiry. We've seen from other inquiries over the years that you sometimes have to inquire into the inquiry if things don't go through, but that is part of the waft and weaved of our democracy and the way that we do things.
So a bit like the child sex abuse inquiry, a lot of questions over whether this is the right person to conduct it, him having been someone that's been behind judicial decisions when he was a judge to say that people will have to move out of London, I think it was to Milton Keynes, that they've got no right to actually stay in the places where they were born or where they've been living, that the councils can actually ship people out, effectively a kind of social cleansing.
I'm not sure.
Well, he has. I mean, he's been involved in a case before he took this up.
So is your point that there shouldn't be an inquiry or that
No, that he's not necessarily the right person to do it because of these previous decisions he's made when he was a judge, which appear to show his support for social cleansing. Anyway, Martin, what do you make
of it? There is considerable doubt about the independence of British inquiries because of the change in the law is in 2005, I think it was. The Pat Finucan Centre in Northern Ireland has been calling for an inquiry into collusion between the security forces and loyalist paramilitaries for years now, but they've not been calling for a British inquiry because British inquiries are no longer judicially independent. Even the Savile inquiry and the previous inquiry into Bloody Sunday took years and years and years to get to the bottom of that. So there's considerable scepticism about the British inquiry system. I think the jury is out, if you like, on this inquiry, but it's not unreasonable for the victims to believe that they're not necessarily going to get justice from this. Just think how long it took for Hillsborough to be played through. And the obvious strategy for the establishment here is to just kick it into the long grass and keep it there. And that's generally what British inquiries are supposed to do.
I don't think... But the point about... and. You know, it should never have taken so long, of course not. But in the end, through all sorts of forces and people, and I'm a great believer in people being able to continually affect this, otherwise I wouldn't be a Democrat, we did get to the point in Hillsborough.
Well, that's right. I mean, just said that there has been a change in the law. I mean, there's always a question. I mean, if you create an inquiry, you're passing it to the judiciary, and the judiciary is supposedly independent. But the changes in the law in the 2000s led to a situation where the government basically controls the remit of the inquiry and what it can actually do and can't do. And that's why the Pat Finucan Centre in Northern Ireland has always been opposed to British inquiries into what they're concerned about.
Well, to clear this up, maybe we should just put a link on our show page at thisweek.org. UK up to this 2005 Inquiries Act, because at the time I remember there were a lot of criticisms of it, saying actually it means that these inquiries, judicial inquiries, will have ministers interfering in them. So that's just not acceptable, particularly when, I mean, you can't expect the government to find themselves guilty in this sort of case.
Well, that's right, and that doesn't mean that inquiries are pointless. It just means that they're potentially toothless. And, you know, it's legitimate for people to raise questions about this. Let's see what he comes up with. Maybe he's going to surprise us. But, of course, there's another issue, which is that perhaps criminal prosecutions should already have been initiated. You don't need to have an inquiry when a crime's committed. The police should just get on with arresting people.
I think maybe the most shocking thing about this whole tragedy was the fact that literally 6 or 8 months before the fire, the local people in the Grenfell Action Group actually put up a blog post saying it's going to take a major disaster or a fire to get anyone to listen to us, Karen.
Yes, no, I mean, that is shocking, and of course the whole thing is shocking and awful.
And they will say they're still not listening. They may well say that.
Yeah, and as people have said, it's the confidence of the local community and other people living in blocks that needs to be assured at the end of this process.
Martin, can you see social housing policy changing as a result of all this? Do you think there will be really any changes?
Well, one would hope so. I mean, it was a Tory government in the 1950s that built the most council houses in Britain. And if there was a sea change like that across the spectrum, that wouldn't be a bad thing. And I understand that the Conservatives, for example, are part of the Labour-led administration in Bristol, and they're supporting the creation of new social housing. Well, then, you know, that's good. Perhaps everybody should, if we can all get everybody on that page, then maybe it shouldn't even be controversial that we need affordable housing for people on low incomes.
Yes, a bit of basic stuff, really, isn't it? Anyway, we're going to
shouldn't really need to dispute about it.
We're going to talk about some not basic stuff now. That is transhumanism. I did a fascinating interview earlier this week with a guy called David Livingstone, who's written a book about transhumanism, calling it The History of a Dangerous Idea. He's from the US has written several books on some subjects which, you know, I find fascinating. But this is this idea that technology may actually become more powerful than humans through the idea of artificial intelligence. And so I asked him, what is transhumanism?
Transhumanism is basically the belief, it's kind of a Nietzschean belief, that we can transform ourselves into whatever we want. So that means that we can use genetics, we can use any kind of science, we can to alter ourselves and basically, in their minds, improve ourselves.
So you're not talking just about, say, personality. You're saying that actually physically we could as well.
Physically, yeah. So it's things as minor as plastic surgery, but things more complex like using smart drugs, like actually, you know, the attempt of turning us into cyborgs.
Well, Nietzsche was around. Nietzsche was around before any of this was possible.
Of course. But Nietzsche basically laid the groundwork for, I mean, the whole idea that God is dead, that so that man is allowed to reinvent himself.
Now, we've also nowadays, I mean, we're talking about in the United States and Britain, we're now starting to see the emergence, quite legally, of designer babies.
Exactly. So that's all falls into transhumanism. I mean, not officially, let's say, but that it's basically those are within the interests of the transhumanists. Just look at how Google is developing. They've got a new company called, first it was Alphabet, now they have 26 for the number of letters in the alphabet. And basically they're, you know, without trying to sound paranoid, they're basically trying to control almost everything, artificial intelligence in particular. So, you know, the guy who's considered sort of the guru or godfather of the transhumanist movement is Ray Kurzweil. And he's one of the head of engineering at Google. And so everything comes down to what they view as the singularity. So they believe that, which is a new age occult idea, and that's not by accident. So they believe that our scientific evolution is accelerating to the point where we will have created artificial intelligence, and the singularity basically refers to that point in time in history where we have created this other, basically another life, and because we will not be able to. We don't know how that life will behave. It's the singularity. It's a point in history which is a turning point for humanity, where it's a point in history that we are no longer going to be able to predict what's going to happen beyond that.
Now, the obvious thing here is potentially cheating death or having a kind of life form which can go on forever.
That's the idea. That's one of the main goals of the transhumanists, is try to achieve immortality. So things like cryogenics and so on and so forth.
But that's not much good, is it, really, freezing someone forever? I mean, surely the idea, if you're a real, like, top guy at Google or wherever as a transhumanist, you want to be able to say that in my family, my children don't die.
Yeah. That's why I call it a dangerous idea. It's a lot of wacky nonsense, and it's basically a fascistic idea. It's also totalitarian. It dates back to eugenics.
Martin, a bit of a big subject, but what do you make of these transhumanists? Do you think we should take people like David saying that we've got to keep an eye on these lot seriously?
Well, it's clearly there's a lot of things to think about, isn't there, as these new technologies emerge.
And one of the points he's making is that the these people are way ahead of the legislation. They're just doing what they want. There is no law that governs all of this.
Well, we need to start thinking about what we're going to do with these technologies, because they're clearly coming on stream. So we've got to decide what our ideas about this are, what's legitimate, what's not legitimate.
Karen, what do you make of
it's pretty heavy stuff for a Friday evening, isn't it? And
we'll be talking about it more after 6 o'clock.
I should listen into that. But I think Martin's right in that the sort of democratisation of technology and so on. I mean, we need to work with that and do that, and it is an amazing opportunity. I'm not sure that I either want to live forever or wish that on my children, but
it's a bit weird, the idea of a whole sort of bunch of people who are saying,
pretty
well,
weird.
My kids will live forever but yours won't. Anyway, we'll be talking more about that after the
look
news.
Look forward to it.
So that's the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks, Karen Smith.
Thank
Labour
you.
MP for Bristol South.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.